All right, today is, what is today? July 13th, I believe.
14th.
July 14th, right. It's Bastille Day. My name is Troy Reeves. I'm with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. I'm here interviewing Tracy Hong about her time here on campus. Tracy, to help us out with sound quality, can you say your name and spell your last name?
Sure, Tracy Hong, T-R-A-C-Y-H-O-N-N.
Okay. I'm just going to turn this up a touch.
I got a whistle, too, I noticed.
Hope that comes through loud and clear.
It probably will.
Okay.
All right, so I gave you a list of general topics, and we're just going to go from that for today. So I noticed from your resume that you have a degree in art history. So the first question is, how did you become interested in art and art history?
Right. Well, I grew up in southern Indiana. I went to high school in Jeffersonville, Indiana. It's a suburb of Louisville. Not a suburb exactly, but functionally in my family, both my parents worked in Kentucky.
Okay.
And the high school was a countywide, rather large high school, and not, I think, a great one, but I had a really good art instructor, and he offered some art history. So I took my first art history class in high school. That was, and I went to Indiana University for my undergraduate work and was interested in several things and knew I'd probably be getting a general education kind of degree in a humanities subject. And I started taking art history right away. And they had a wonderful faculty, and was very happy with my program there. So,
Okay. So, did you have an interest in? I guess how did you get an interest in art in general?
Yeah, I was. I have an MFA from Madison, but I was interested in art. I took some studio classes, but I don't ever remember thinking I might major in art. I'm taking a parenthetical right here, which is just, it's unusual to be talking to someone while doing an oral interview, so I'm trying to adjust to the sort of to that. And I might be nervous for a minute, but I was always interested in art. And when I was in high school, I had a boyfriend who was interested in art and printmaking, something I'd never heard of. I was very bookphilic always. I found out quickly what printmaking was. Indiana happened to have a really famous etcher there, kind of the way they did here. So Rudy Pizzotti was at Indiana. I never met him, but I knew about his work. And when I was at Indiana, I took a non-credit class in a rare book. It was offered in the Lilly Library, and it was for, you know, an introduction to rare books. It was after hours. It was really fun, and I was always super interested in books. Never thought about going into librarianship, but it's not, you know, there's no through line that's planned unless you're a really more determined person than I. But looking back, you know, this is an opportunity to look back, and you sort of think about what were those highlights. That was definitely something that really turned me on. And I don't think I thought about it very formally, but I was clearly really loved looking at books. I loved learning how to handle them, and that definitely is something that's continued. So at IU, I had a little grant I got from the Friends of the Library for funding to help me go with a graduate class that I was an undergraduate in. I was taking on Italian Futurism. Susan Barnes was the faculty member who taught that class, and that was her area of specialty. And like a lot of people, I sort of followed what was already going. You know, there were some great scholars there. One was Northern Renaissance, Molly Ferries. I think she's still at IU, quite a well-known scholar. I loved her work because I was also passionate about people. So, you know, I was impressionable. She was great. And this other person, Susan Barnes, is that her name? Yeah. Was a Giacomo Balla scholar, and she took a group of students to New York to go to the Winston Collection, which was a private collection put together by a woman named Mrs. Melbourne, who had this extraordinary collection of Italian Futurist work in her home. And she'd been married to Harry Winston, hence the name. And it was a great opportunity. But it's funny, that little grant, I don't remember, they probably did a fundraiser as we do here, you know, selling books. But it was specifically the art library, and they had a really great art library at IU that I continue to support just a little bit. I mean, alums can do certain things. That's the thing that impressed me. I also worked when I was at IU for, I was a student at an honors division that was an undergraduate program, not a degree-related honors program. They've changed the way it's kind of instituted at IU, but at the time they were a series of classes that you could elect to take, and then in your own major, if you had an honors program, you might get an honor certificate. I wasn't even a particularly stellar student. I'm not sure how I was lucky enough to fall into this crowd, but they were very encouraging to me, and I got an opportunity to teach when I was an undergraduate through them, things that really influenced my life. Mm-hmm. And they had a this would no longer be PC, and even then it was suspect, an Ideas and Modern Man class. So it was a general humanities Western Civ sort of course. Mm-hmm. And they invited faculty, and they were usually young faculty from across the campus to teach it. And you could design the curriculum to your own taste. So if you were an astronomer, as my husband is, and that's where I met him, you might emphasize, oh, I don't know, you know, something different than maybe the history of science or religion guy might. Anyway, I got to do that for two semesters with a woman named Julia Bondanella, who was in French and Italian, and, mm-hmm. And that was really great. So that was my undergraduate degree, and you asked me, what did I plan to do when I got out? Mm-hmm. And I had no idea. Are your levels good?
Yep.
I had no idea. I knew I didn't want to go to graduate school right away, if ever. It wasn't really on my immediate radar. Mm-hmm. It was the late 1970s, and employment was, it was very hard to get a job, and I was pretty naive and sort of didn't know what I was doing and, you know, did this and that. So I did a lot of different things. I worked in daycare. I met my now husband and moved around with him a bit. I lived in East Lansing and Columbia, South Carolina, and Stevens Point, Wisconsin, which, and in fact, that's how I ended up in Wisconsin, was that he got a job teaching at UWSP. When I was in South Carolina, I got a job, partly because of my work at the Honors Division. For a year after I'd gotten out of school, I was just doing secretarial work there. I got a job as an administrative assistant for the art department, and it was the first time I'd ever been around artists very much, and it was the first time I saw a printmaking studio. They had a really great studio there. It was sort of a one-person job department where you would have your own media, but you were in control of that program. And Boyd Saunders, who taught printmaking there, I didn't know at the time, was very influential in the field, along with my boss, John O'Neill, who was a painter, but printphilic and did prints, I guess, and there's something called the Southern Graphics Council that was, they formed along with a few other folks, and that was a regional, obviously from the name, get together among printmakers, but it survived as the national get together of printmakers. So the program that printmakers would go to once a year in this country is the Southern Graphics Council. That's become the de facto sort of main group, and it's not only academic, so it's kind of a cool, printmakers are sort of interesting people. They're certainly known more who were in in the academy, but they really do come from all walks, and they tend to be gregarious, not happy to be alone in the studio, but more interested in working collaboratively with others. So I got introduced to some of the, you know, I liked a lot of the printmakers there. I knew a number of the artists, and my age made it much more natural to affiliate with the graduate students who were in the program there. So, so that happened, and I took a non-degree after-hours class in rare books at the library again. That was University of South Carolina. They have some cool archives there too. I think they have a big film archive, as I recall, from RKO or something. I don't remember now. Listen to public radio, sort of all those things you do when you're sort of intellectual and young and maybe not, I didn't know what I was doing, but I was interested in that. And when we moved to Stevens Point, there was even less employment in Wisconsin. I thought Wisconsin was a wonderful place. I'd only been here at 14 on vacation and thought it was like the best state in the world. coolest place, literally cool, which I really liked. And Stephen's point was less than fabulous, especially post living in a city, even though Columbia isn't exactly, you know, the metropolis you would choose. It was actually a really interesting place to live. It was integrated. There were a lot of, there were people, it was a real city, you know. There were all kinds of people who lived there, and it wasn't just the school. Whereas in Stephen's point, sort of culturally, the only thing was the school. And of course, it was much smaller than the university I'd just come from, and I didn't have a job. So I did a lot of volunteering at in Stevens Point, and then I started taking classes in non-degree studio classes in printmaking, which was just, you know, had been in my head for a long time. I was interested in the in multiples, had been exposed then to more, and had traveled a little more. At Stevens Point, probably in my second year there, maybe the third, two things happened that were important for my career, what became my career. There was an exhibit in Madison called Breaking the Bindings. And it was and it was just before you came in, trying to remember, was it at the then Elvium? I think it was. But I actually was going to look it up. So I think the Elvium was where it was. There's a catalog, but it's now, that book is packed. And it was organized by Walter Hamady of the art department. And a seminar of students he had, and they did a survey of book arts activity across the country. And in my field, fine press would be the traditional thing you come from, which is sort of very nicely made books, handset type, maybe etchings, beautiful binding, kind of high-end, limited edition, etc. But what was clear, and maybe handmade paper, which is something that Walter, he started the mill, a mill here. But there were a lot of changes that took place in the 1970s in that in the field. A lot of it in the departments like this one, where you had other kinds of activities going on in the arts. Printmaking would be usually was where it was embedded, and people got interested in art in sequence and bookmaking, and the skills, all the craft of that, with that enterprise, but also with maybe different kind of intent or values or more artist-driven projects. So whereas in the past, you find press publishing is more a collaborative organization of maybe artisans in a sense, this was something more driven by purposeful intent and kind of full control of an artist. So that we think of as artist books, which are pretty fairly well understood now, or fairly generally accepted. But at the time, even the term itself was just getting established. So the idea of what's an artist book? So what this group of students had done was survey and actually travel in some cases across the country, or somebody was going home for winter break. My understanding is they would then go out and to Boston or wherever they were and do an interview with an artist. And from that research they did, they put out a call. I believe this was all invitational. I don't think it was a juried show. To the artists they had met and researched to show this work that was called Breaking the Bindings. And it was a very, it was influential on me, but it was also, it's a critical exhibit in the sort of history of the field. It really was an important thing that happened. And so there were books by all these artists coming from geographically all across the country, different places literally, but also with this sort of new activity that was clearly going on, but they really penned a moment in time and exhibited what was happening. That was very exciting. Two of the people in that class, Ruth Lingen and Catherine Keene, Kathy Keene, came to UWSP as visiting artists for like 3 days. And I think there was a young art historian no longer there. He was only there a very short time, and they were friends. And he invited them to come on the strength of that show and had some money. I don't even know how it got organized, but I was a student in the department. And these little posters went up that were very sort of do-do-do. They had this kind of sensibility that was very endearing, and they were on handmade paper. They were hand-set, hand-printed announcements of this visit, and they were going to give a talk about breaking the bindings. They would talk about their own work, and there were three sessions, and the other was a hand bookbinding demonstration. And I was like, I'm there. I'm on this. And I went. And it's really funny now, you know, you meet students often who are very enthused, and sort of just something happens and they're all excited. And you've seen that a lot. And now I think, you know, I must have probably, I was very polite and I was probably somewhat timid, but I was absolutely enthralled. And a little bit like, you know, tell me more. Kathy's work. Kathy was doing, had shown work from her MFA, and there were all these handmade paper aprons that she made with text. I'm reaching for something to show you, but I think it's over by my calendar. Kathy was my teacher at the Silver Buckle Press when I became a student later. This fall at the Chazen, actually starting August, the end of this summer, she's having a show at the Chazen of her book arts work, some of her work. So it's kind of, that's a very, it's a nice moment. So I met these gals, and they were great and really sizzling. And I had seen the show in Madison. I might have even come back to see it. And I knew I didn't want to stay in Stevens Point any longer. So I started learning more about the program here. When I was in South Carolina and took this rare book, sort of, you know, continuing ed, I don't even know how formally it was a class. I just remember going to a series of lectures and hands-on. There was a woman, I think her name was Charlene Gary from London. She was a publisher. She was very interesting, and she gave a slideshow of fine, contemporary fine press work. And they were all British, except for one. One person, she said, she was somewhat imperious, but interesting. One person's work she could recommend to us, and it was this man, Walter Hamady, who lived in Wisconsin. So I had heard Walter's name that, you know, some several years before I ended up coming here. And then I met these women who talked about Walter Hamady as being very important to them. And maybe I had begun to see more of his work. So his name was resonant for me. And I met him, I don't remember when exactly. I should, because the first time I came and visited and saw the Silver Buckle Press, I think Walter was on leave and Ruth Lingen was doing, she had just gotten her MFA and she was teaching maybe a one semester class as an interim for him as a sabbatical replacement. And I saw the studio in the art department, and then they took me over to the Silver Buckle Press and I met Mary Laird Hamady, she was introduced to me as. And I didn't know him yet, and I didn't know if this woman was his daughter. It turned out she was his soon-to-be ex-wife. And that's kind of interesting for me, sort of down the road of my own life. But she's an important Wisconsin person, too, who was getting an MFA when I came in, and so we were in the program together. That takes me up to coming here, I suppose. So, how are we doing? Is this okay?
Yeah, it's perfect. So we're talking mid-80s by this point.
Right.
And you've been in Stevens Point for a few years.
3 years. Three bad years.
You mean bad in terms of just professionally?
Well, low to no employment for myself. My husband was teaching in the astronomy department and had a tenure battle. Or a retention slash, yeah, it was just politically very unpleasant. Stevens Point, you know, I think that's a separate oral interview, really, Stevens Point. But I was just I was really unhappy. And that question about, you know, what do you do with your degree? It became clear that nothing was coming to me. I mean, it took me more years than it might others to sort of galvanize that I was going to have to direct this program for myself.
Right. And at this point then, again, you don't want to go into this too much right now, but at this point then you're receptive to go
somewhere.
Both of you seem to be receptive to go somewhere else.
Correct.
All right. So, since we have got to Madison, let's talk about then the MFA at UW. I mean, you sort of already got the let's delve into actually getting here and getting the degree.
So I came here in 1985 as a special student. I enrolled as a special student, and I was a special student for two semesters, which is a you're paying for credit for a course. It's not the same as auditing. You pay more. I don't know how the program is now, but at the time, you were not admitted formally to a graduate program. You were admitted to a graduate level course. You could take and pay for it, and then on the expectation or hope that you might be getting into the program, and then you could, those could become part of your formal graduate school transcript. The year that I came, two other people came that I'm still friends with, also as special. I mean, I'm friends with several people I met at the beginning, but it's interesting to me that Marta Gomez, who also works here in Memorial Library, she's runs the conservation lab. She came the same semester as I did as a special student in printmaking at Madison, as did Mario LaPlante, who's a dear friend and a printmaker who teaches at San Francisco State University today. This program, in those years, printmaking at Madison was a really big deal, a really big place. It still has a high reputation if you look at rankings. But it's not the same program it was, and it's mostly because they admit very few students. I don't understand the whole ins and outs of that, but when I was in the program, the directory of all the graduate students in the art department was a pretty big paper document, pages and pages of students. And there were maybe 30 a year, so you can imagine in a three-year program, you've got quite a lively enterprise of students. I don't even know exactly what the numbers are. I'm sure people do. But it was rich. And I think that was the year I came was Warrington Colescott's last year. And he had been the reason that, among, I'm sure, others. But he had really been the person who, I think, did the most recruiting. He was that equivalent of Rudy Pizzotti at Indiana. They're of the same sort of group. There's in Iowa. There are other places that have these really influential printmakers of this sort of post-war era. And most of them all now retired. But it was the end of what had been, I think, a really lively period at Madison in art and printmaking. And I think it probably was the tail end of a certain era when I came here. Walter Hammity was going through a lot of personal problems, I think, at the time, and my expectations that he would be a sort of personal mentor to me were disappointed. I think, you know, retrospectively, that's probably was I had unreal expectations maybe of what your ideal thesis advisor might be, but he certainly, his effects are large because he introduced, through him, I met all these other people here, and he has a certain set of values and standards that have influenced me a great deal. He did not teach a lot of hands-on. So my real sort of nitty-gritty training came at the Silver Buckle Press. In my first year, I worked on internship, I guess, at the press, and Kathy Keene was the person who directed it. And it was a book about the Silver Buckle Press, so it was all kind of self-involved. I mean, it was a little publication about history of printing and a history of the collection. It was all sort of loosely written, I think, by Deb Riley. I mean, Deb Riley is the author of record on it. However, I don't think she thought it was going to be a published manuscript. It might be something she prepared for a talk. It was handed to me to set. And I remember some frantic last minute, yes, you can release this, thanks to some of the sort of printing history, a printing history person, I think, that she had been reading up from pretty heavily. So I just remember there was a little drama around this project I was working on. But it was a fun introduction to everything. Mm-hmm. And Kathy had been a student of Walter's for longer and at a better period of time, was involved, I believe, in that Breaking the Bindings exhibit, just a kind of more... he's a difficult person, so I won't be the first to have said that, nor the last, undoubtedly. And he's a challenging person. He was really, really challenging, so...
Can I jump in here?
Please.
And I want to know, so you talked about you had a hands-on internship at the Silver Buckle Press.
Right.
Before coming here, before...
Right.
How much hands-on...
None.
Work? Okay.
None.
So this was all, you had seen the work.
Right. Okay. Right. So I was learning it in school. I mean, I certainly was taking an intro to letterpress printing. I think it was called Intro to Typography. And it was all new, although I thought I'd be the oldest graduate student in the world, but it turned out that wasn't true. I think I was 29. There was such a great range of people here. You know, I definitely wasn't. That turned out not to be as scary as I thought. But I had a lot to learn. I'd say that wasn't the difficult thing, because it's not that hard to learn letterpress printing. It just takes time. It really takes time. But someone who's interested is going to be able to get that. And the people I was working with cared about doing it right. There's a lot of, you know, it wasn't sloppy, my education. It was probably narrow, if anything, but not, but it was definitely exacting, I guess. I lost my train of thought a little bit. Oh, I was studio classes that I didn't really have, and I never had. I never had those. It turned out I didn't really need them. I mean, could I have used much more instruction in drawing when I was an undergraduate? Sure, I could have, but it was all right. You know, it worked out all right. I got admitted, so yeah.
So. You mentioned Kathy Keene. You know, you just talked a little bit there about Walter Hamady.
Right.
You've talked about a couple of your cohorts. So besides the internship, and you mentioned taking classes, what other classes?
Right.
I mean, what classes do you take to get the degree that you got?
Well, here the program, you have a number of hours in the studio in your primary concentration. So in printmaking, I concentrated, though, in book arts. I took papermaking from Walter. I took letterpress printing from Walter. There was a great division in the art department between students who worked with Phil Hamilton, mm-hmm. who also taught typography, right? Mm-hmm. And Walter Hamady. Who also taught typography. It was like a civil war had occurred. There were two separate shops. They were differently maintained, and there was a lot of jealousy in that program, who you studied with. The people who were in the neutral zone that you could work with were Ray Gleckler, and I did. He taught relief printmaking, and he's an artist who also retired here, still in Wisconsin, had work in the recent faculty show. Fran Myers, who was Warrington Colescott's replacement in etching, and was married to Warrington. Fran died unexpectedly 2 years ago, and it still seems like a blow. It's not even 2 years. So most of those people I studied with independently, actually. I didn't take etching formally here. I did take lithography with Jack Damer, who's just retiring, another big printmaker. And I took some classes elsewhere. And Jim Dast was my first, an incredibly influential instructor, and he was to many people. I don't know how well known this is. And Jim taught a book binding class that all art students took who were at all interested in books, arts, or graphic arts at all, even ones who weren't going to be making books necessarily. But he taught a really great class in his home. I think over the years he taught it in different places. And it was a semester-long introduction to what's not as often referred to as non-adhesive and adhesive bookbinding. So you learned some really simple structures, and then he took you up into case making for sewn multiple signature books, and you walked away with two hardbound books and maybe a book repair. And I signed up and took the exact course again the next semester because I knew I really wanted a grounding in that. And I worked for Jim when I was a grad student. So he comes up a lot as someone who's really influential. Jim went to the Newbery after he was here at Madison. He would go down to Chicago and was studying conservation. You know, he's really completely the reason we have a conservation lab here. He designed that lab that's down there now. That field, conservation preservation, is very dear to my heart, and it has a lot of broad influence. A lot of the Hamidi's teachings came out of ideas that were being established by conservators. There are a lot of conservators who work with artists and have for many years. I'm not talking about just like how do you maintain your paintings, but people who work in paper and book conservation labs where there's a lot of influence back and forth. And there's been an organization for a long time called Paper Book Intensive, which was started by some artist, Tim Barrett at Iowa, who's a MacArthur Fellow, papermaker. And conservators, Gary Frost, another recently associated with Iowa person, I think previously in Chicago, a conservator. So bookbinders, papermakers, book artists, printmakers, all of these kinds of fields, those people getting together and having a really rich exchange of ideas. A lot of the principles that come out of that are common now, but they weren't common in the 1980s. So things like the word archival. You know, a few years ago at the bookstore, I bought a plastic ledger little binder thing, and it's imprinted, you know, with the word archival is on there. That's ubiquitous almost now. You know, it's that common. A 99-cent binder has that word archival on it. What does that mean to the sort of average Joe, right? But that comes from a conservator. That comes somebody who went to Florence after the flood and helped, you know, rescue a muddy book. A lot of things happened from the 1960s on, and that knowledge actually has kind of gone out into the world, at least for material culture things, and had a lot of influence on everything from, I don't know, just think scrapbooking. That didn't just happen. It came out of sort of a series of ideas and changes in the world. Okay, so the program at Wisconsin, it's a little freewheeling. This has never been a program, to my mind, that's very restrictive in terms of the order of business for you to get through. You are always on your own here. It's always, as far as I know, been that kind of program. The great thing about the art department is that they weren't restrictive about your working in other areas. So there have been lots of people who came through who also took a glass blowing class, or they were working in metals, or they ended up switching to sculpture, or woodworking. There are other programs, Iowa's one, I think, where they're much more strict about your curriculum once you enter. That's possibly better for an overall education, right? But I suspect it wouldn't suit everybody, right? And there's some artists who are going to come out of here and then really do really well. Printmakers that I went to school with are Phyllis McGibbon. She's a faculty member, professor at Wellesley College. Other people who are independent, a photographer now, Michael Starkman in San Francisco. You know, there's people all over, and not some went on in the field. The person that I'm very close to, both as a friend and professionally, is Diane Fine, who's a faculty member at SUNY Plattsburgh, and that was her first job out of school, and she ended up staying there the whole time. It is a lovely program. Mm-hmm. And we did some collaboration as graduate students and then continued to do some work together.
So thank you for that, the overview of your program. Now, you also, I'm assuming, moved to this town, the city.
Right.
So for you, what was Madison like? You know, at that point, which would be mid to late 80s.
Right. Well, since I lived in Stevens Point for the 3 years before I actually moved to Madison, Madison was the place you would go for fun. The Madison was a place where you would go to a specialty import grocery store. And it used to be the place that you could go. I mean, it was then the place you could go to a restaurant. But in the mid-1980s, that meant Ovens of Brittany was the sort of restaurant you could go to. And now every chef in Madison with any roots here can trace his or her roots back to Ovens of Brittany. When one of the first occasions I was at an Ovens, it was on Monroe Street. And it was really kind of a sweet place, and they had a little bakery in the front. But this is just to tell you what Madison was like in the 1980s. So they had lovely bread, and you could, take something home. And I asked the young woman behind the counter if they had baguettes. And she looked at me. Her eyes kind of got puzzled and big, and I thought maybe she didn't hear me, and I said, "Do you have any baguettes?" And she looked at me with this really questioning expression, and then she said, "Do you need a little bag?" Right. That was food culture in Madison in the 1980s. I'm sure lots of people knew what baguettes were, but this young woman clearly did not. Madison has changed a lot. At the time, though, the opportunity to be, a big university and the Capitol and all the things I loved seemed better expressed in Madison. I love my adopted state. I loved that we had same-day registration. I loved that we didn't allow guns. I loved that we had this long commitment to environmental matters. And one thing I did like about Stevens Point was their natural resources program, which was clearly so wonderful. And I love public radio, which I brought with me from Stevens Point, but I think George Mossy might have brought me up. I mean, if I hadn't had public radio, Lex University of the Air to listen to, I think I would have felt much alone, you know?
Mm-hmm. What part of town did you live in?
We lived on the east side between the Carstensons and this wonderful, we had such great, great family and friends, and on Orton Court on the east side. It's a little one block long street that dead ends into the lake. We got a flat there. Jonathan Cooper lived upstairs. He's a librarian at Historical. And the Carstensons lived next door, and Clarence Kalin lived across the street. Do you know who Clarence Kalin is? Mm-hmm. He was a member of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. He was a long-standing, visible presence in Madison. He only died a few years ago, and he was a wobbly and a commie and a great Madison, person. Incredible. So it was fun, really, really kind of neat people to meet and get to know. And the Willie Street Co-op was now where the Macaulay Legal Justice Center is on Williamson Street. And it really, actually, I think it was expanded from maybe while we lived there. So my number's low in the co-op. It's that kind of thing you're proud of in Madison. It's sort of ridiculous. Then we lived on Jennifer Street across from the middle school, and had a flat, and then ended up buying the two-flat house we lived in. And now we live on the near west side. At the time we were looking, we couldn't find anything on the near east side. And we bridged that gap, which I think is one of the funnier ones in Madison, since I still seem to meet people who presumed to know a lot about me based on where I live, which is the sort of east side, west side divide, right? So that persists. And I like where we live a lot. We live on Hoyt Park, and I didn't know that side of town very well, so.
So at this point, as you're getting your degree, which happens in the late 80s, what's happening in terms of occupation?
So I worked in the library in the conservation lab for Jim Dast. I had a student job at the Silver Buckle Press. After Kathy Keene left her, the person who replaced her was Barbara Tettenbaum, a book artist who is the head of the program at Oregon College of Arts and Crafts today. Very influential in her field. And she introduced me to this paper book intensive program. I took courses in 1989, a summer, like 10 days of classes. So she was definitely an influence and had also studied with Walter. What was your question, Troy?
So it was, this degree.
Right, what was I working on?
Yeah.
I know, one thing I wanted to tell you, because it's very UW-centered, is I worked for a program in Wood, WUD. I worked out of Union South for a program that was then called GUTS HASH, which stands for Greater University Tutorial Service / Help at Student Housing. And that was a res hall. I know GUTS still exists as a tutoring program. They have a small paid staff, but it's mostly a group of student volunteers. And I assume they still have a somewhat a paid staff. I had the best boss I've ever had at GUTS HASH. And her name was Beth Black, and she was a graduate student in the English department working on a PhD in literature. And they usually hired grad students, I think, to work in the program, although we had undergrads and grads. And I ran a program. I worked for them for a year on general stuff, and I worked another year as a study specialist working with, I was hired by the nursing school. So I taught nursing students how to take multiple choice exams, which I first learned more about myself and then felt damn straight I could do that. I think I could be a nurse if I needed to. I could at least pass the test. It was really interesting because they write very difficult tests, but it was really an exercise in trying to tutor people in close reading. It was very good for me. I guess the first year I taught study skills because I remember learning a lot more about them, and it definitely improved my own, habits and abilities as a student. I took it all a lot more seriously, I think. The program had really great advisors. Brad Hughes was one, Blair Matthews. There was this wonderful woman from the School of Engineering, and I don't think she's here anymore, I don't remember. But I remember one of the many things I liked about the program, besides that the services were free and mostly student-run, volunteering, they took it seriously. So those people who were, it was an extra committee duty on their daily planner, when I got interviewed for the job, it was a real interview, and I really appreciated that. I was serious. I didn't want someone to give me a job. I wanted to compete for it, and I wanted to do, perform well and get it. And that was really great for me. I think, and what I see over the years, especially working with undergraduates here, is such an important program for any of the Wisconsin Union Directorate committees that students serve on. There's a selection effect, perhaps. I'm one of the best, certainly best, a really great student, but I haven't worked that closely on staff with undergraduates. And a recent one, Katie Garth, who's a great designer, a graphic designer, worked on the art committee there. And I just see what quality they attract and what kind of performance they get out of their students. And there's something, that's a really good thing at UW. So I'm all for it.
So these employment opportunities were all going on as you were getting your MFA.
Right. Okay. Exactly.
And then this special course in 1989, was that here on camp? You said you took like a 10-day...
Oh, the paper book intensive was in New Mexico. It was at Ghost Ranch near Abiquiu, where George O'Keefe had lived, actually. But it's, I think, So paper book intensive, that program, now they hold it every year at Oxbow in Michigan. But it used to be a floating program, so it would have a local host. And Pam Smith from the press of the Palace of the Governors in Santa Fe, New Mexico, who's a wonderful artist, and ran that press for the state for many years and has a background as a journalist. In any case, she was our local host, and we were mostly out at this fairly remote camp, but it was great. There were people from all over the country, really interesting people I met then that I got to know later here professionally, and I didn't always even remember I had met them before until I went back and looked. I mean, when I look now at that list of people who were there, I'm like, oh, I know Chip Schilling in Minneapolis. I met him that summer. You know, there were so many interesting people there. I didn't even realize how many. So, and some people I've stayed in touch with that I met in 1989. It's neat because the people who are, everybody's sort of camping or in small cabins, but the instructors or sort of senior people there every evening, you know, on rotation, they're giving talks informally about their work. So Stan Nelson from the Smithsonian was there and was talking about typecasting. Claire Van Vliet was there. She was, I think, taking classes, not teaching. She's a MacArthur Fellow and book artist who taught here and was a very influential person. I think it was a one-semester sabbatical replacement for Warrington Colescott when Claire Van Vliet taught at Madison. It might have been, say, 1964. She kicked some butt while she was here. Art Hovey writes about it a little bit in that book with Warrington on Wisconsin printmakers. Mm-hmm. She really is an incredible artist, but among other things, they bought a printing press that's used for letterpress printing. They bought a Vandercook press. She recommended this person that she knew about that they might want to hire, Walter Hamady. So you could really trace sort of this book arts thing back to Claire instead of Walter even, or at least she put it out there that this person from Michigan was someone they might want to keep an eye on. And he was. You know, he really, he did a lot. Started a lot of fires and really inspired a number of people. So, yeah, that was cool.
So now we are...
post-grad school?
I think so.
That was that was much less painful than graduate school.
Yeah. I do have a couple of questions.
Sure.
The first is, to get an MFA, did you have to do some sort of thesis, sort of final project?
Oh,
so could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I didn't say this, but I formally stopped studying with Walter Hamady. And I was actually here for 4 years since I came as a special student, and I really needed the full three. I stayed for 4 years. So I was one of those grad students they could give tenure to, you know. But after maybe my second year in the graduate program, I just felt I would go mad if I had to hear Walter's voice anymore. I'd heard everything he had to say. He wasn't saying anything new. And his personality was difficult for me, I would say. I was disappointed in my experiences with him. And he seemed, and I do think it was because Mary was a grad student in the program. I didn't even know her that well until about the time she left. But I think he sort of disliked or distrusted all his female graduate students. He was really awful. Just awful. You ask anybody from the same period, they'll say the same thing. And I don't think that I have great respect for him, but not on that level, not on some, he could be really bastard. Anybody would say he was an SOB too. That's mm-hmm. nothing novel. So, and he, I guess he always felt put upon, and maybe that, like, he didn't get enough here. He talked a lot about that when Jim Escalante was hired. Jim Escalante's been a great colleague to me, and I'm proud that I saw his, like, you know, interview when he came. He gave such a great talk about teaching and teaching art and innovations in the classroom using the computer. You know, it's great to live through these times because you've really seen a lot of change digital on technology front. But he was hired by Donna Shalala under something called the Madison Plan, which was to really change the face of our faculty, to up our diversity. I don't think they use that term as much then, but Jim Escalante had been a student of Walter's, a very good student of Walter's, who'd really done a good job elsewhere. But he was hired with a big bump, you know, an extra bump in salary. And rather than just, you know, open-armed, oh my goodness, welcome, fellow colleague, no. Walter posted the blue book or whatever it's called, all of the salaries for the faculty members, including his own, and, you know, sort of highlighted gems. And that's a horrible thing to do with to a new faculty member who's coming in under this. Obviously, you're not, you know, you're contributing to this kind of, I don't know, that's what Walter was. Mm-hmm. So where were we?
You needed a break. We're talking about your thesis, so you needed a break from...
Yeah, so I started working with a man named Ted Pope, who was a really important early digital person. I think he got a lot of crap in the art department for working with computers, but he had quite a following of students. He was a lovely man to work with. He was an intellect. He was a gentleman. And he was a scholar. You know, he was great for me. I needed somebody that I could talk to that wasn't all full of drama. Ted was it for me. And Ted was the chair of my committee. He wasn't in my area even, really. And that's kind of unusual. By that time, though, I was working with Phil Hamilton also, doing a lot of credits with him. I did continue to work with Ray Gleckler the whole time I was here, and I worked with Fran Myers. And my MFA show was both, I showed additioned works that I'd done, books, and I had a series of altered books. So they were books that I had introduced changes to either text or images that were in made bookstands. The bookstands were awesome. I got a lot of help from my friend Mario on the woodworking part of that. So that was a cool show, I thought. It was pretty neat.
What do you mean by alter? I mean, altered you just
books.
Said it, but what?
Right, okay. So, most of them were not, they would have been editioned books, but some of them with sort of vintage bindings or something that would be tactile or very visually compelling anyway. But maybe the books that, I never worked with any book where I thought I was destroying a, like, a valuable thing. But then I might alter the text block or cut out sort of part of the interior of the book and insert some different content or play off of the title. One book was a sort of Victorian, was actually the oldest and decorative binding called Her Crime. And I altered it to say, I stole this book. And it had a, which I did. But there was a story and was a backstory. It was sort of not stolen like from a bookstore. But part of that was written, was text. I always did a lot of writing. The reason I was interested in bookmaking was the chance to handle a lot of different areas, that all of which I was interested in. So I didn't really tell you this at the beginning, but, you know, I did this undergraduate degree that was very general, and the world wasn't just waiting for me or anything, but I was very interested in being a generalist. Very early on, I thought, I'm a generalist. I don't think I really knew what that was, but in a sense, I trusted my instincts because I was interested and had some abilities in several areas. publishing is really sort of the natural thing for someone like me. I like words, I like editing, I love copy editing, you know, I can't help myself. I like composing, I like designing, I love corresponding, you know, just there are a lot of kind of things that all go with collaboration and say publishing. And my ending up in artist books per se isn't predictable, but it's natural. It made sense to me. And in my whole career, the irony of it is that I did something very specialized, you know, as perceived by most people, right? But I did something more specialized or sort of arcane by today's standards than most people could imagine. But I stuck to my guns. I am a generalist. I did get to work on all kinds of things. I didn't do it in any way I could have imagined at the beginning, but I kind of had a plan. I'm just not a really... I'm not the kind of person who like knew from 18, oh, I'm gonna be doing this. But I did have deep convictions and I kind of stuck with those. So I feel, you know, I feel glad about that part, you know? So you wish you were somebody else, but sometimes you might say, I wish I'd known at 16 I wanted to be a doctor or whatever. That's not my, wasn't on my radar. But you know what I mean? There are, you know, people like that who are very self-directed that way. I think the ways in which I'm self-directed, I'm probably only more aware of now, which is the kind of concern about certain aspects of it. How we deal with people, service, integrity, not necessarily my own, but having stolen a book, I guess I lost all creds, but some larger values of service or concern.
Mm-hmm. Does that? Okay. Thank you. So we're going to start to wrap up for today, and
sure,
that's, we're going to move now to you get your MFA in 1989. What things are you doing after that?
Okay, sounds good. Do you think people who are having oral interviews have some feeling of, and it's such an opportunity, you know, nobody pays that much attention day to day, right? So it sort of feels like this special spot. Lit moment. But what I find myself thinking is, I wish I had a better story. I mean, my personal story, I just wish I had like a lot of anecdotes or something.
Every orchestra is different. Yeah, we all can't be Bill Cronin in a sense that,
right,
you know, every story has,
right,
a nicely
right
wrapped narrative within it.
Exactly.
So after your MFA, you get that degree, are you still able to work at these jobs on campus?
I did briefly, and I think in that way you can extend your student. I know, and actually Jim hired me, but I think I was just trying to remember, was it a PA, was it an LTE, what was the designation? I don't remember. I really have worked off and on for the libraries since I was a graduate student. Mm-hmm. There was the possibility of a permanent job down there. That was one thing that was sort of on the, you know, on the back burner. I really loved conservation. I didn't get formal training. I only ever had what's called bench training, you know, and mostly from Jim. When I got out of school, I did some commissioned box making for Pace Prints, which was where Joe Wilfer worked. Joe Wilfer is somebody I haven't mentioned, but an important Madisonian and printmaking, in the world of printmaking person, who ran Pace Prints, that was set up by Pace Galleries as a publishing concern for prints. Mm-hmm. And Ruth Lingen from here went there and worked. Kathy Keene from here went to New York City and worked. And they had some publications. I made some boxes for, and I was just saying last night to Mark, because there was a article about Chuck Close and there's coming out on Sunday in the New York Times, but I remember they decided not to publish this reduction self-portrait thing by Chuck Close, but I was going to hope to get to make boxes for this project, because mm-hmm. You'd get a copy, so mm-hmm. I didn't get my Chuck Close. I worked for myself as a freelance as a conservation book repair person. So I did all kinds of wild things for, you know, for private clients. Mm-hmm. Rebinding their journals into, you know, or putting their journals into bindings. That's a sort of old-fashioned one that seems silly to me a little bit, but I got paid for it. And but I did have good skills and decent training, and otherwise I might be repairing your family Bible or something like that. Mm-hmm. Around that time, I got hired by the Historical Society to work in the conservation lab there. And that was a really important experience for me because I'd never gotten to do work with large flat paper pieces. And I learned a lot from Robin Carlson, who was the person who trained me there. And then I replaced her when she went on maternity leave and stayed. I was there a few years, I don't remember now. But it was, I just saw so many things pass through your hands that are just remarkable. And you get to meet squirrely people like Jack Holseeder and Jim Danke. I got to know some people there that that were fun. The editorial was always nicer than any other group in the Historical Society, because working with your hands, even if you're a labor historian, is still, I mean, you're not the labor historian, but the labor historian still, you notice, doesn't really respect you, right? Right, because you wear an apron at work, so you can't really be too smart. Yeah, yeah. So I love the collections over there. I always thought when I first got hired at Wisconsin, at Madison, at the Silver Buckle Press, my first job was to move the collection from College Library, where it had been housed since 1973, into Memorial Library, this room 236. And when I got this job, I thought, I really loved working at the Historical Society, but I would much rather be in this building looking out at it across the mall rather than the opposite. I did compete for a job there, but I'm so happy that it turned out that I worked for the library system. So
then that might be a good place to let us stop so we can then pivot next time. But we went through, you know, a fair chunk of your life there.
Right.
And I'm wondering if there's just anything on your mind about that period that you feel appropriate to want to get on this section of the interview before we move on.
Well, I will say that it was an irony to me. There are two things about this moving business that are interesting. You know, I'm just ending my career here, and I've just moved this collection. And I hope I never have to move this collection again, right? But it won't be on the library's dime if I'm ever involved in that, presumably. That's one thing that's just interesting to me, to have that experience, because it's unusual. So I got to, at least in my own way, I set this up and started it here, and then it's ended. The other thing that was really an irony to me was I did this book of Laurie Moore's work before I really was hired, I think when I was an LTE for the Silver Buckle. That was a cool project I can tell you more about, but next time. But the first thing the libraries asked me to do, printing, was a retrospective poster, 30-year retrospective of Walter Hamady's work in Special Collections. And I was like, wow, that's cool. You know, it's cool to get to do it. It's also really like, oh my God, he's going to hate whatever I do. But he was pretty kind to me and loaned me some blocks of collage. He works with rubber stamps where he was, and then he would have blocks made so he could print them, these little sort of creature-like things, and he did loan me a bunch of those blocks. But when I look at the prints, and there, God knows there are some inventory that's getting taken care of right now. You know, they've just been around forever. They're really under-inked. You know, they weren't badly printed; they were nicely designed. But I was so timid, I think, in this job. You know, like, I wanted to do it so perfectly, and I was like, oh my God, I just couldn't even get enough ink on the page. I was anyway. So that's a good kind of funny place, I think, to stop.
Well, yes, this concludes the first interview with Tracy Hahn. Tracy, thank you so much.
You're welcome.